This Do Lectures episode features founder and managing director at the Centre for Inclusive Schooling of Children with Autism, Shannon Eales, recorded live at the global event in Victoria, Australia in 2014.
Thank you, and thanks to the organisers. It's such a privilege to be here with you. This area is really special to me. The first company that I was part of starting with my very good friend Bryony Cole was based here in Falls Creek. So it's been a few years since I've been here. But I had this real pang of nostalgia driving through Mount Beauty and then driving past the village, and it really made me reflect on everything that's happened since I was here and everything that is about to change, which we'll get to a little bit later. I'm going to talk to you about what I've been doing for the last 7 years or so, and some of the lessons I learnt from that, and then what I'm up to next. It doesn't have a name, so I thought I'd just start with a pretty photo anyway. So in 2001, I was at university and I began working with children with autism, and that was my part-time job. So best practice for kids with autism, what the research tells us works the best, is lots and lots of hours of teaching, ideally before the child turns five. And we're talking 20, 30, 40 hours of teaching one-to-one with a student each week. So I was doing that. It's called behavioural therapy. And the technique is called ABA, or Applied Behaviour Analysis. And I'll talk a little bit about that, because it's ABA in autism that really drives me and why I'm so passionate about it. So I was going into people's homes and doing this work with kids, which was incredible, and led to everything that I'm doing now. So ABA, as I said, a lot of it is one-to-one. It's based in the principles of behavioralism. And what happens essentially is that if I can give you an ABA 101, and anyone who watches this, I'm oversimplifying something very kind of tricky, but what we're doing really is looking at the function of what's happening, why a child or an adult is displaying a particular behaviour, and then looking at what do we need to teach that student, where are the gaps in the learning, and taking those skills, breaking them down into small parts, teaching that very systematically, pairing it with lots of fun and reinforcement, and then generalising that skill to the natural environment, whether that be the playground or school or home or holidays or wherever that is. Now, you can go back one. You can think about it like a sports person, right? So when you are a cricketer, you don't say, let's go to cricket practice, we're going to play a whole game. You say, let's go to cricket practice and we'll bat and bat and bat for a little while, then we'll field for a little while and we'll bowl for a little while, and all of those things will come together in the game. And that's what we're doing with kids with autism, and that's what's so powerful. It's essentially giving lots and lots of opportunity to learn skills and to practice those skills, then going and using it in the natural environment. And what we're aiming to do is to teach kids with autism all of the things that typically developing kids would learn from their environment or the social interactions that they have, which the kids with autism don't learn that same way. And it's not, and I'm talking a lot about the therapy because I think it's so powerful and it's important that you understand that, but it's not about changing who the kids are. There's two schools of thought sort of in autism, and there's one where there's accommodation and we sort of change the environment to suit the student, and then there's where we come from that says actually we think we can teach these skills, and we don't just think it. There's about 30 years of research that tells us that we can. So we're very much focused on the teaching of skill. So anyway, so that's what I was doing, and the kids make really significant progress. We're talking not just a little bit, it's different for different students, but kids making 3 years of progress in one, and when kids are very young, what we're trying to do is catch them up to their peers and fill in all of those gaps. You'll have about 30% of kids who are engaged in this intensive therapy will go to school without needing support. So it's really, really powerful, and I often talk to parents whose kids maybe don't make that level of progress, but they'll say things like, you know, we can go on a holiday, or we can all sit at the table and have dinner together, or, you know, he can use the bathroom on his own. And they seem like very small things to us, but to families, they're huge and they're life-changing. So knowing that this therapy existed, I guess, brought me into the next part. And so I graduated university and went and did some other things, spent some time up here in Falls Creek, and then in 2008, came back to Melbourne and started working with kids and families in schools. And to be completely honest, I actually don't remember how it happened. It's all a little bit of a blur that time, as I think most things are when you're on kind of the verge of something bigger. And started working with kids, and a really obvious problem emerged. Something became very clear to me. I was watching kids in schools, and so many kids weren't making the progress that they could. And so much money was being poured in with very, very little outcome. So I was knowing that these kids were getting the schools, for some kids with autism, schools get additional funding to help support those kids. So I knew that there was money, and I knew about this therapy or teaching practice. And I thought, well, why aren't we just bringing those things together? You know, this is a solvable problem. Why aren't we just doing what the research has told us for three decades works? So that was 2008, and I took some time off. Thankfully, I was nursing at the time, was able to do that, you know, nights and weekends, and took some time off to really understand the problem and what really was going on here. Was there a policy problem? Was it just about what people thought? And figured out that actually it was more just about people's attitudes and what they thought. And set about creating the Centre for Inclusive Schooling of Children with Autism. Name seemed like a good idea. You don't want to try and say it on the phone. So CISCA. And really started working with individual families. And what we were advocating for was a better use of funding. Yeah, and that me, felt like we could be doing more with the money that we had. Now, this idea was different to what, I guess, happens traditionally in disability education. The talk is always about, oh, there's not enough money, it's so hard, blah, blah, blah. And I was really determined for us not to get sucked into that and not be focused on how hard this was going to be, but instead on what we were able to do. So we're working with individual kids and families, and they would come and say, you know, Shannon, my child's going to school, and we'd really like an evidence-based program to go there with them. And I would talk to the school and kind of bring the people together. And that would happen. That makes it sound very easy. It wasn't, but nonetheless, that was the process. And then, which was good, but I was never interested in just some kids. I wanted all kids with autism to have access to this if their parents chose for that to happen. So, and we were coming up against some pretty significant resistance. I was working with another agency called Autism Partnership, who are world leaders in educating kids with autism, who have an office in Melbourne. And there were all these people telling us, this isn't possible. What you're saying can't happen. You know, this isn't going to make the difference it would. You're not going to be able to change the practices. And what we needed to create was an example of what was possible. And that really has kind of set the tone for everything we've done from there. It's really about creating examples of what can be done and what can happen. So in September 2009, we joined with a primary school. It's a government mainstream primary school called Moomba Park, and an incredible principal called Tony Kelly, and said, we really want to do a whole school approach to this. We want to show what this can really look like as a whole school, not just these individual kids doing programs and families having to defend that every other day. And he said, okay. And we said, okay, great, let's do it. So we launched in January 2010 with 12 kids in a school of about 250 typically developing kids. And now we're in the fifth year. We have 22 kids. We're full. And there are many, many, many children who would like to be there that aren't or can't because it's full. And not only that we continue to work with the Department of Ed, and I'm very, very hopeful for the future of education for kids with ASD. And we have grown our team. This is actually a couple of years ago now, but we have a staff of about 60, and we work together with Autism Partnership, the other agency that I mentioned. We also started a early intervention centre-based program called Little Learners, where kids come to the centre 4 days a week to enable both parents to work, because early intervention is expensive for families. And then we've done some other things. And essentially what happens is that we have a client, a child or an adult who needs something, and it doesn't exist, so we make it. And that's the wonderful thing about the team that I work with. And this is some of them. This is actually at my birthday party a few years ago, and these are some of our staff. And one of the fundamental things that we teach kids is how to copy, because you learn so much through imitation.
And this is them kind of giving examples of this kind of instructional, kind of like a Simon Says game. And what's special to me about this photo is that this is on a Saturday night, and they're still thinking about it. And that really is reflective of the passion of the people that we work with. And so very lucky to be part of a team that's not limited by what other people think is possible, not limited by what currently exists. And that's really, really important. I've sat in a lot of meetings where it started with, oh, this is so hard, and I just want to like tear my hair out. I don't want to talk to you about how hard it is. So there have been days when it's felt like we're climbing this mountain with this kind of cart. And we've come up against lots and lots of resistance, lots of people telling us that we would never be able to do something. Lots of free character assessments of me and what I was doing. And my favourite one probably was once someone back in, I think it must have been 2009, and this was a person who was had some responsibilities around education. You know, they had some control and some power, and they said, oh, Shannon, she's just an entrepreneur, as an insult. Like, that's probably my favourite one because I thought, well, thank you for the compliment. Concerning, you think that's an insult. So that's probably my favourite. And there are some, I'll just jump back one second to talk about the things that I didn't expect. And Pete Williams, I saw him speak a little while ago, and he talks about three different kinds of people when you need to move a table, and that there are people who will watch, people who will help you, and people who will sit on it, on your table when you're trying to move. And I think that I underestimated the number of people that would try and sit on our table, and not just sit on it, but like pick up all the other furniture they could and put it on it to try and stop us from moving it. But there are advantages to trying to do this and understanding behavioralism. And so what I wanted to show you, and I guess some things that I've learned along the way. Now, this is obviously the mountain, but this really poorly drawn line actually represents something called a behaviour escalation cycle. So what happens in behaviour is that there's some sort of a trigger, there's an acceleration, there's this point up here, like an extinction burst, and then it comes down the other side. So if you think about the child in the supermarket, who wants the chocolate frog or something, and down here they're like, Mum, I want the chocolate frog, no, and so they start to escalate. And what happens is you get up here, and right before things get better, they peak, and it gets much, much harder, which is the point where parents give the child the chocolate frog because they're like screaming on the ground in the supermarket, and who wants to deal with that? But it's also, I think, the point that lots of people give up on really good things because it's so, so hard right here. And I think for me, what I learnt in one of those moments was that's the worst possible time to give up. It's when you need to dig in and start doing more and being more places and talking to more people and generally just really working harder. And that's been our focus, I think, through everything that we've done, is just be very, very good at what we do and be so good that people can't ignore what's happening, rather than worrying about all the negativity, focus on what you're doing and do that very well. Now, this is the not giving up part is great advice if you're on the right path. It's really awful advice if you are not on the right path. So how do you decide whether you're on the right path or not? I mean, I can only talk about me and how that feels and what's been useful. I think for me, it's been about asking myself a question, and the question has been for the last 6 or 7 years, does this mean better programs for more kids? And if the answer is yes, then we should do it. And everything that we have to do to make that happen is just a list of things to do. Yeah, some of them will be really hard and some of them will be really difficult, but it's just a list. And if I can be okay with that and not get stuck in the, oh, this is so difficult. The more you say it's difficult, the more difficult it gets. So I look at it just as a list and looking at the question and making sure that we are still doing what we said we would set out to do. And as you get bigger and you have more programs, this becomes a very active process of remembering why you started what you did. This top bit up here with all the equations is that I wanted to pose more of a question and perhaps a conversation that we can have later about this intuition. And I think for some of you in the room, this also happens and you get this sense of whether this was right or not. And to me, that feels like a bunch of equations happening very quickly in my head. I want to know if I'm crazy or other people feel that too. But that's what it feels like. And I'm interested in that because I think it's quantifiable. And I would love to know how to teach it, I guess, so we could define it. And perhaps I'm wanting to define something that's not definable. But nonetheless, that's for you. So what's next? Okay, so usually when you get to the end, near the end of your talk, 5 minutes to go, you can relax and you've done the hard stuff. Well, what's coming next for me? So a little while ago, I decided, I think about what can I do to make the biggest difference possible, and I started considering becoming a politician. And the room goes quiet, all these little laughs. I've been working on things for a little while. I've just gone through this process called pre-selection, which, let me tell you, has nothing on being here with you. This is much more tricky. No. And so I'm now the Liberal Party candidate for the seat of Albert Park, which is this amazing... Thank you. Which is this amazing part of Melbourne that goes all the way down here in St Kilda, right up to South Bank, and takes in wonderful things like the Arts Centre and the beach and Albert Park Lake. So I'm very, very lucky. This obviously presents a whole bunch of new challenges. Yeah, and the doing, I'm passionate about people. Problem solving is like my favourite thing to do, has always been. I was the kid with that book of, I don't know, I'm not going to try and explain what they are because I don't know what they're called and it'll be a long conversation about nothing. But anyway, problems. And I'm still passionate about that and making things better and creating these examples of what we can have. And that's the reason that I'm choosing to do this. So the doing part of it is okay, right? I'm going to have to do a lot of stuff, but that's all right. I think the two biggest challenges I feel at the moment, one is going to be the perception of other people. And, 5 minutes ago, I was the girl working with kids with autism. That's great. Now I'm like the budding politician. Same person, same skills, same passion, same determination, completely different expectations and perceptions of people. So that's going to be a challenge. And I guess for me, I'm just going to have to show people. You know, there's no point trying to convince anyone or talk to anyone. I'm just going to have to show them. And they're... will be a lot of doubters. Yeah, there'll be a lot of, well, she'll never change anything and politics is going to suck her up and she's going to, you know, whatever. And I guess to those people, I say, okay, you could just get off the table. But I will just set about showing people and that's fine, I can do that. The second thing I think about this is, I guess, the challenge of making sure that I don't lose me. And don't lose this what brings me here, what makes me love places like this, and ensuring that I stay this person. And for that, I guess I'm going to rely on the people around me who know me. If you see me becoming some, you know, whatever, something that's not what I am now, feel free to give me the proverbial kick via Twitter. That's okay. But they're the challenges going in. But it's also very exciting. When I was thinking about this, I think I decided that in order to change anything, you have to be willing to risk it changing you. And we will see what happens over the next little while. Just going to leave you with one more thing. So as I kind of go through and things are tricky at different times or stuff just feels crazy, there's a couple of other things that helped me. One is Steve Jobs when he said, remember, one day you're going to die. That's good. That's pretty grounding. And then the other is that I also find inspiration in these like corny quotes with pictures on the internet, which amongst a bunch of cool people just feels even more dorky. But I just thought that I would leave you with this one. And some of you have probably seen this, but when stuff is at its craziest, I think when times when I think, God, why can't I be that person who just wants to go and, you know, live on the island and not do anything? And I just remember that I would always rather be the ladies in the front than the ladies in the back. So thank you very much for listening.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out.